You, who all were here last session?
I was.
Only you. You were there, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Except Gail. Okay. All right. So, Gail, what we did was, you know, we started with chapter 2.
We're in chapter 2 now?
We just started a couple. Last session, we started the chapter 2.
Okay.
And.
Four
sutras.
Okay.
We went through four sutras in chapter 2. Chapter 2, as you know, is a collection of thoughts on the philosophy of klesha. Klesha is all the suffering and pain that we go through, what causes that suffering, and then goes into the theory of karma and reincarnation. And there's a very fairly detailed discussion on the entire Sankhya philosophy, you know, on which yoga philosophy is based largely. So there's several statements which relate to the Sankhya philosophy. And then toward the end of this chapter, it introduces the eight limbs of yoga called the Ashtanga Yoga. Okay, so that's the first five of the eight limbs of yoga I discussed in this chapter, and the three which relate to meditation, they are in the third chapter. Okay, so that's kind of the overall structure of this chapter 2. Okay, so we went through these. I'm just going to go through this very, very quickly. Okay, the very first sutra in chapter 2 defines what's called the Kriya Yoga. And it says Kriya Yoga is the combination of these three, you can call them activities, Tapas, Swadhyaya and Ishvara, Pranidhana. These are the three things that constitute Kriya Yoga. Tapas is what?
Self-discipline.
Self-discipline, you can call it, self-discipline, toughening up. Making yourself strong physically, mentally, emotionally, doing things which are totally out of your way, out of your comfort zone, just to develop that sense of toughness. And the idea is to do the tapas so that you can withstand all the dualities of life that we are faced with. Okay, that's tapas. What is Swadhyaya?
Studying
of the self. Scriptures, so we understand the concepts through the scriptures, then we apply to ourselves to understand ourselves, basically. So that is Swadhyaya.
So it extends beyond studying the scriptures, but I guess the scriptures talk about studying and knowing the self.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Adhyaya means to study, and swa is the self, the study of the self. But, you know, again, commentators, they take it both ways. Self-study means you study the scriptures, and study of the self means you study yourself.
Okay. So but they are they're almost one
and
the same.
Interlinked, because through your study of the scriptures, you understand the concepts, and then you try and apply those concepts to you, and then you study yourself, understand yourself better. That's how they describe that. And what is Ishvara Pranidhana? Surrender to Ishvara. Okay. Again, we spent a lot of time on Ishvara here, so make sure that you understand the concept of Ishvara very well, because Ishvara has been defined very specifically in the Yoga Sutras. See, the moment we say the word God, it has many different connotations, and every individual has their own kind of way of looking at what God is or might be or should be or whatever. So, God is a good loose translation, but we must understand that Ishvara has been defined nicely here, so we need to stick to that definition of Ishvara. And then once you understand that, then surrendering to that entity is called Ishvara Pranidhana, which means letting go of the ego and surrendering to it. You can think of it as a higher reality or a supreme reality. That's what Ishvara Pranidhana is. Okay? So all these three activities are given the collective term of Kriya Yoga. Okay? And the purpose of Kriya Yoga is given in the Sutra 2. There are two purposes mentioned. One is Samadhi Bhavana. Samadhi Bhavana means you develop sort of an attitude of Samadhi. Bhavana can be attitude or feeling or an understanding, anything. So basically it says that you move in the direction of Samadhi. And the second is Klesha Tanukarana. Klesha is a term that he's going to define next. But he says the purpose of Kriya Yoga is to diminish the influence of the Kleshas, of the sufferings, five sufferings that he's going to define right next after that. So twofold purpose of Kriya Yoga. One is to diminish the suffering or the fivefold suffering that we face, and the second is to move in the direction of Samadhi. Okay? Okay, and these are the five klesha that he has defined in this sutra. What are the five kleshas? Avidya is?
Ignorance.
Avidya is ignorance. Vidya means vidya. Is knowledge. Vidya is true wisdom, you can call it. Knowledge and wisdom. When you add the prefix a in front, it negates it. So lack of knowledge. Well, lack of knowledge means ignorance. No knowledge. Depending on which term you understand better. It's ignorance of lack of knowledge. Avidya. Okay? Then what is asmita? Egoism.
Egoism.
Asmita means I am something, you know. See, there are two ways this term asmita has been defined in the Yoga Sutras. Okay, two ways. In the very first chapter, the Sutra number 17, it defines four categories of samadhi. And one of them is based on asmita. Now, that asmita is different from this asmita. Okay, now.
Two definitions
of the same word.
Okay. In the
Yes, Vitarka, Vichara, Ananda and Asmita, those are the four categories of Samadhi, four stages you can call them. And there, the word Asmita means I am-ness. I am-ness. Asmi means I am, and when you add the suffix ta, it makes it like I am-ness, or the quality of being I am. Okay, so that's why they call it the I am-ness. In the first chapter, the word asmita means I am. And there is a period after that sentence. That's a full sentence. I am. That's it. Okay? This asmita means I am, and then there is a fill in the blanks. Okay? There's a fill in the blanks after that.
As in you may be defining yourself,
or whatever.
Having your feeling.
I am happy, I am sad, I am fat, I am ugly, I am good, I am bad, I am a father, I am a mother, I am an engineer, I am so-and-so, and everything. All the labels that you can attach, to attach to this sentence. So the first chapter, Asmita, is I am, period. No more words after that. I exist. I am pure awareness, I am pure consciousness. That's all basically it is. Okay, nothing beyond that. No labels attached. In this one, I am has a lot of fill in the blanks after that.
Okay. That's dealing with the ego.
That's the dealing with the ego. Okay, so that's the ego part. And then there is raga and dvesha. What is raga?
Attachment.
Or likes, you know, strong likes for something, strong desire for something, that's all raga. And dvesha is a sense of dislike, hatred, aversion, you know, those are the words you can use for dvesha. And abhinivesha is
fear of death.
Fear of death, clinging to status quo. That's another way of looking at it. your desire to maintain status quo. That's the abhinivesha part. So these are the five kleshas. Kleshas are sufferings that are defined in the sutras. Okay. Now what this sutra says is that the avidya or the ignorance that we have defined is the kshetram. Kshetram is a field where other things can take birth. So a field where other things can grow, basically. So avidya provides the growing field for all the other following this one, which are the asmita, raga, dvesha, and abhinivesha. So those four are a result directly of avidya. Avidya causes them to happen, basically. Okay, that's all it says here. Okay, then these kleshas can be in one of these four states. Okay, so what are the four states? Prasupta. Prasupta means
dormant,
asleep. Then supta is sleep, asleep, and prasupta is deep sleep. That means they are way deep down into your subconscious levels. Okay? That's the prasupta part. Okay. Then there is the next one is tanu. Tanu means
feeble.
Yeah, they're there, but not quite able to raise their ugly head yet. They're trying to come out. Feeble, okay?
Is that the same tanu from the previous? It's attenuated?
Yes.
Thinner?
Yeah. Same tanu. Then vichinna. Vichinna means now they are able to either appear on the surface or they are going back into the subconscious level. They are kind of up and down. Okay? They're able to make their presence felt, basically. So that's the vichinna part. And udara. What is udara? Udara is active, really. Now that klesha is the one which is really active. So you have a strong desire for a cup of coffee. It's very active and you have to have it. You cannot do without it. Okay? That's udara. Okay? So, four states of these likes and desires, you can call them. So, they are prasupta, tanu, vichinna, and udara. These are the four states. Deep sleep, prasupta is sleep, that means dormant, that is weighed up down in the subconscious level. Alright? And then, tanu is kind of made feeble, diminished to some extent. And vichinna is kind of coming up and down. At one moment it's there, at one moment it's not there. And then finally, udara is totally active. So this is how much we covered last time. Okay.
So if you achieve enlightenment, achieve all the knowledge, then you will have no ignorance because
yes.
You have all the
yeah.
knowledge.
Then you go past that. Yes. So that's the whole idea.
Obstacles fade away.
They
don't appear.
Because you don't have any ignorance.
They would be
if there's no ignorance, there's no.
Or even beyond that.
Even beyond that.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's no ignorance. What that basically what it means is when you're able to kill your ego, right? In the sense that all the negative aspect of the ego, when you're able to kill the labeling capability of the ego. You know, what's bad with ego? What's wrong with ego? It's labeling capability. Ego is required.
Labeling.
You know, putting that fill in the blanks kind of thing, that we talked about. That's what's wrong with the ego. Ego by itself is not bad. Ego, we need the ego. We need all the four components of the mind. The mind, intellect, ego, and the memory, four components. And we need them all four to function. But what we don't need is the ability, is what the ego does to everything that we experience. It puts a label and then creates a mess with us. That's the kind of what we want to get rid of. Once we have been able to achieve that goal of eliminating its labeling capability, we are good to go. Okay? All right, so let's slowly move on to the next ones now. Okay. All right, now this is the definition of avidya itself. All right? So let me go through the sutra. Anitya. You want to repeat? Anitya.
Anitya.
Ashuchi.
Ashuchi.
Dukkha.
Dukkha.
Anatmasu.
Anatmasu.
So let me repeat these four words again. Anitya.
Anitya.
Ashuchi.
Ashuchi.
Dukkha.
Dukkha.
Anatmasu.
Anatmasu.
Then the next four are the opposites of these. Nitya.
Nitya.
Shuchi.
Shuchi.
Sukha.
Sukha.
Atmakhyatihi.
Atmakhyatihi.
Avidya.
Avidya.
So the definition of avidya, that's what the whole purpose of this sutra is, to define what avidya means. So there are four things mentioned here, and four negatives and four positives, basically. So, to regard the impermanent as permanent, which is anitya, the impure as pure, that is shuchi, and painful as pleasant, that is sukha and dukkha, and then the non-self as the self. Okay? Atmakhyatihi. So, these four are kind of the definition of avidya. What is avidya? So, basically everything that we do is it's lopsided, you know, topsy-turvy in a sense.
We've got it back.
We have it backwards, yes. So our job is to understand that we have it backwards and then to fix that. Put it in the right order then. So, impermanent as permanent. Can we think of some examples?
Sure, we think this life is permanent. Or yes. Permanent.
Yes.
Or we want the sun to always shine.
Yes. Right, right.
Something pleasant is happening and we want that to always be the state.
Right.
But then I think the opposite too. When something bad is happening, we think that will always stay the same. But it doesn't.
So we think impermanent as permanent. Things are changing, but we think they are permanent. And then impure as pure. Any examples?
I don't know if this fits in. No, that would be the next one.
Well, the example that most commentators give is the physical body, right? Okay, we always give so much importance to the physical body, you know, putting all kinds of lotion and making it so nice and lovely. And they say that if you ever look at the inside of the body, what comes out of from the inside of the body? In every form, right? It is a mess. Okay?
I think that goes, thinking that we're not, that we're really permanent, that this is really something that we need to cherish, which, I mean, you can't take care of it, but...
You just cannot... You cannot adore it. Yeah.
What about mental states? Because sometimes you can think that your ideas or way of life is very pure.
Sure, absolutely. It applies to everything. You're absolutely right. You know, you think that your mind is very pure, very clean, and it's all messed up in a sense. It happens all the time. And that's why people fight with each other. Because, you know,
they think they've found the answer.
They found the answer, and this is it. And what they think is the answer, and that's the whole asmita thing, egoistic thing. Because then in their view, what they think or what they know is the only right thing. And that causes every problem in life. What conflicts happen because of that? So, Not realizing the reality, basically, that's what it is. Unreal as real. Something which is not real, something that's not permanent, we think of this as real and permanent, and that's making the whole mess. So impure body is given as an example by most people, but other things also, you know. We eat food which we shouldn't eat, thinking it is good for us.
Sure, you can because it tastes good, and after a while it's like,
what? Yeah.
Not good for your body.
What did I do? It feels bad.
So all those are examples of, you know, things we do upside down, backwards. Okay, painful as pleasant, same example. Food, for example, you know, we eat food which could give us a lot of pain and suffering, and yet we think it is pleasant. We do exercise, you know, all kinds of things we do which are painful, but we think they are pleasant. And we overdo it, not do it enough, things like that. So, again, all that is a part of avidya, ignorance. Ego takes over, yeah. And the non-self as self, again, the same thing, you know. Self is just pure consciousness, but we think everything else is the self, and that's the main definition of asmita, or the egoism, is to understand non-self as the self. So that's all part of the ego stuff. So this is the definition of avidya. Avidya is lack of proper knowledge or proper understanding. Avidya. So it's a nice one. Anitya ashuchi dukkha anatmasu nitya shuchi sukhatma khyatihi. And then avidya. Okay, this is the definition of asmita, or the egoism now. So you want to read the Sanskrit again? Start with that. Drik. Darshana. Shaktyoho. Ekatmata. Eva. Asmita. Okay, so drig darshan shaktyoho, let's try that. Drig darshan shaktyoho. Ekatmata. Eva. Asmita. Asmita is the final word, which is the definition of asmita, or the sense of egoism. Okay. Now, this is a little pregnant sentence, because it takes us to the whole concept of Sankhya Yoga. Like I said, there are concepts of Sankhya Yoga which are prominently sprinkled in this chapter. So what is Drik and what is Darshana? That's what we have to understand. Drik means one who sees, one who is observing. And darshana is what is being seen, what's being observed. So what is the context here? What are we talking about? Who is the observer and who is the observed?
Well, they say the seer, or Purusha, he's the witness of our instrument.
Right.
We think the instrument
is the Purusha.
Is it. You know,
that's it, right.
We think we're the instrument. We don't understand that we right. watch the instrument.
So, what it's saying is, their Shakti. Shakti is power. Shaktioho means the power of the seer and the power of the seen. We equate the two, in a sense. We kind of superimpose one on the other. Okay, and we don't recognize that they are two separate things, they are two separate entities, and that is what is causing a lot of the problems. And this is called the asmita. Ego takes over, basically. What we're saying here is that ego takes on the role as if it were the Purusha, as if it were the Lord, it was the boss, basically. Okay.
And how do you explain that to somebody who's not really seeking? Because they'll just, I mean, this is like a mental disease.
Yes.
You know, to disengage yourself from your mind, basically, mm-hmm. and to observe your mind. I mean, there's a mental disorder named.
Well, we're all mentally deranged.
Yeah, no, but in the medical world, I mean, I'm a nurse, so that would be, if I tried to explain this to a doctor, he'd go, you're talking about, you know, schizophrenia, or you're talking about.
Oh, I see.
I know, I know. Well, but in a sense, every one of us is mentally deranged in some ways.
Sure.
Every one of us, you know,
sure. because of our identification with the ego,
yes,
and thinking we are the ego, and that
right.
is
that's mental derangement. Yeah,
yeah,
that's absolutely right. So you're right. Yeah. Well, how do you explain it to a doctor? You don't. They will not. They will not understand. They will not even make an attempt to understand. Yeah, they don't.
Well, it's like you almost have to seek this out before you can ever understand it.
You have to be a seeker. Yeah, you have to be a seeker. You know, that's what they call sadhaka. You have to be a sadhaka to be able to understand some of these concepts. And then when you apply them, they become beautiful in your life. Then, you know, the life becomes beautiful then. Yeah. So.
The seer is not the seen.
Seer is not the seen. Seer is the observer. Seer is the. You can think of it as the boss, in a sense. Mm-hmm. But our identification with the ego, with the prakriti, with the buddhi, with the intellect, we start thinking that that's everything. With those, you know, we talk about these four entities, right? The mind, intellect, mm-hmm. ego, and the memory. Remember those four.
Yes.
Always. Okay, so those are the four, and we identify with the ego, basically. Ego takes over, and then we start considering ego to be the boss. And because ego loves the past, as we mentioned, remember? Ego loves the past and the future. It does not like the present moment.
For sure.
So, and.
Well, it just keeps pulling from the memories from the past
right.
to make the decisions of how to
That's
react right.
right
now.
That's right. That's right. It's. It's a concept of reaction based on our past experiences and not responding based on what the truth is, what the reality, underlying reality is. You know, we need to understand what the reality is and then respond intelligently, intellectually. But we react based on our ego, based on our experience from the past. That's what is happening. That's the problem. So this statement that I have taken it from Swami Satchidananda's book, all the English translation, most of these are from that book. So egoism is the identification, as it were, of the power of the seer with that of the instrument of seeing, the body, mind, etc. Everyone okay with that? The difference between, I've written down here, is basically the difference between capital I and small I. And the way, you know, it is explained here is the small I has a dot. And all you need, that dot is the blemish, basically. Okay, and all you need to do is to remove that dot and you make it capital I and you're good to go. Okay? That dot, you can think of that as the blemish or the ignorance. And if you can remove that ignorance, remove that dot, that blemish, then you become capital I. Capital I represents the pure consciousness, pure Purusha. Okay?
So in a sense, could you say, we talk about prana as being the life energy.
Mm-hmm.
Could that almost be prana?
Which one?
The original I.
No.
No. Okay.
Prana is a manifestation of that original I.
Is a manifestation. Okay.
Oh, the original I is pure consciousness.
It's even further back.
It's further back.
So prana is really.
Prana is a part of.
Into the body.
Yes, prana is a part of prakriti.
I'm sorry.
It's part of prakriti.
Part of prakriti. Okay. Oh, all right.
Prana is a part of prakriti.
Okay.
Prakriti, what's that?
Prakriti. Purusha and prakriti.
Right.
Purusha is the pure consciousness. Everything else, mind, body, and everything, that's prakriti.
Oh.
That's what I mean with Sankhya. We'll come to that.
Mm-hmm. I didn't understand the word.
Yeah. Okay. You're familiar.
Paper, I don't.
Prakriti, right?
Yeah.
You understand
yes.
that. Yeah. Yes.
Well, so Purusha and Prakriti are like the two main elements of Sankhya.
Two entities of Sankhya philosophy. Two entities.
Okay.
And they're two independent entities. And our job is to make them realize. Our job is to realize that they are independent. Right now they are all messed up.
Right. So they're like blending together and that's
yes.
how we see them. We
yes.
can't make the distinction between
right.
the two.
That's the whole purpose of that. Yeah. Asmita is that whole blending of the two. When the two are kind of merged together, that's what Asmita is all about. Blending together of the power of consciousness with the power of the intellect. Okay? So the power of seeing, hearing, etc. comes because of the power of Purusha, but we mistakenly identify with the sense objects, mind, buddhi, etc. You know, what they're saying is in everything in the intellect, in the mind field, in the intellect-mind complex, it works because it has a reflected intelligence coming from the Purusha. It's the reflected wisdom that comes from Purusha. And that's what drives us. But then we don't recognize that, and we attribute everything to the ego, and then make that the boss, and then superimpose everything on the ego, and then we are in trouble.
So our mind is a reflection of Purusha?
The power that drives the mind...
The power that drives the mind.
...is coming from the Purusha.
Right, okay.
Power that drives the intellect coming from the Purusha.
Mm-hmm.
The power that makes us see, mm-hmm. makes us hear, makes us taste, all that is coming initially from the Purusha.
Makes us breathe.
Absolutely.
Right.
Makes us.
Nothing else. Makes us.
That prana that you talked about,
yeah.
What makes prana is coming from the Purusha. Okay. It's a manifestation of that. Purusha, I just put down a few bullet points here to understand the difference, okay, between the Purusha and the Prakriti. Purusha is the seer. Buddhi is only the instrument. When I say buddhi, I mean everything, you know, all the four entities, but most commentators, they like to talk about buddhi.
Buddhi is the same as chitta?
Chitta is the combination of those four.
Of the ego, memory, intellect, and the mind?
Mind, intellect, memory, and the ego, that's called chitta, the whole complex.
Okay, wait a minute, I gotta write that down, that's a good one. Memory, mind,
intellect, and the ego. So those four, they have been referred to as chitta by Patanjali. Chitta vritti nirodha, when we say,
yes.
Definition of yoga, that's what the chitta is all about.
So is that considered all the mind chatter?
Yeah.
All the mind.
Well, they call it the mind stuff.
Mind stuff.
Because they couldn't find a better word, so mind stuff. All right. So Purusha is the seer, Chitta is only the instrument. Purusha is pure consciousness, Chitta has no consciousness of its own. That's something that we need to understand. It's very important to understand that according to Sankhya philosophy, the only conscious entity is the Purusha. Everything else runs from borrowed consciousness. So our intellect, they say, is non-conscious, but to function, it borrows consciousness as reflected consciousness from the Purusha. That's how they use the term. reflected consciousness. Chitta is full of action. That's what does all the work, all the action is performed by chitta. But Purusha is purely an observer. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't get engaged in any of the activities. Purusha is attributeless. You cannot allocate any attribute to Purusha. Whereas the chitta or the prakriti is a composite of three gunas. That's why it has got attributes. Three gunas being sattva, rajas, tamas. Sattva, rajas and tamas. Okay. Everything in prakriti, everything in the chitta area is a composite of these three gunas. Sattva, rajas and tamas. That's why it has attributes. Okay. Pleasant, unpleasant, active, non-active, etc.
So the mind and intellect and memory, it goes through all these three gunas.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
They keep, absolutely.
They fluctuate all the time. Very full of change all the time. Constant change. Okay? Now there is another sutra which says Purusha is the Ish, sort of the Lord. Okay? In the sense that Purusha is the overall seer and the Lord. There's a sutra here which says that Prakriti, whatever it does, is for the sake of Purusha, as if it is serving its own master. Okay, so it has two basic functions which we'll come to in one of the future sutras. Bhoga and Apavarga, those are the two functions of the chitta. Bhoga is to provide an experience of this life to the Purusha, and Apavarga is, having done that, Apavarga means total liberation. Okay, so Bhoga and Apavarga are the two functions of the prakriti of the chitta, and they are all for the purpose of the liberation of Purusha. So that's why they say Purusha is the master, and the prakriti or the chitta is the provider. So thus the two are entirely different, but then identifying the buddhi with the Purusha is the superimposition which makes it the problem, and that's what's called the asmita.
So does he go on to say even that is Purusha one consciousness?
Every individual is one consciousness.
And all consciousnesses are connected.
Patanjali doesn't talk about that. Patanjali doesn't talk about that. Patanjali only talks about the individual.
That's all I've heard so far. So
Vedanta.
So
in Vedanta they say that it's connected.
In Vedanta it's different. We're not getting there yet.
Okay.
In the Patanjali's concept of yoga, he is mostly talking about the individual. Every individual is a Purusha and prakriti.
Mm-hmm.
Prakriti can be common, but Purusha, every individual is the same independent Purusha.
Okay.
So you are an independent Purusha, I'm an independent Purusha, and she's an independent Purusha.
Okay.
Okay.
Got it.
Well, once you see that individual Purusha, I mean, doesn't everybody, when one sees it, aren't you connected to the other ones that see it also?
He's saying that Patanjali does not say that.
He doesn't want to talk about it.
He probably thinks it's just a big enough job to get yourself straightened out first.
What?
Good point.
Absolutely.
It's a big enough job to get yourself to this point.
Oh, yeah.
Merge in with something else.
That's much later. We'll come to that later.
Yeah.
He says you get to that point where you can feel this isolation, separation between Purusha and Prakriti, and we'll take from there, we'll see what we want to do.
Yes, get there first.
That's a major first step. Okay, then the other two are the Raga and Dvesha, as we said, they are kind of the two sides of the same coin, very identical in concept. What is Raga? So let's rule the Sanskrit. Sukha.
Sukha.
Anushayi.
Anushayi.
Raga.
Ragaha.
Sukha anushayi raga.
Sukha anushayi raga.
Sukha anushayi.
Sukha
anushayi. Shayi.
Shayi.
Raga.
Raga.
And let's do the other one also. Dukha anushayi.
Dukha anushayi.
Dvesha.
Dvesha.
Dukha anushayi.
Dukha
anushayi. So there are two words here. Dukha. Dukha means pain, suffering. Dukha, okay? Dukha.
Dukha.
Dukha. That sound is not there in English language, so it's hard. Dukha. Anushayi.
Anushayi.
Dveshaha.
Dveshaha.
Okay, so these are the two raga and dvesha. Raga is likes, dvesha is dislike, raga is attachment, and dvesha is in animosity or aversion or dislike, hatred, and all those are words that you can put for dvesha. So basically everything, as we said, is based on an experience. Whatever we experience, like I gave the example of a cup of coffee, right? At some point in life we had the first cup of coffee, and let's say we liked it, okay? And then that's an experience, and then the ego immediately put a label on it, I liked it. And it's also going to add a desire to it, you know, I want it. That's all called vasana, samskara and vasana. Those are the terms that Patanjali, everyone uses, okay?
And that's going in the memory.
Everything is in the part of the memory now.
Yeah.
So there are three components of memory all the time, three components. One is pure memory. Pure memory will say, I had a cup of coffee, which had cream and sugar in it. And I had it on such and such date, at such and such time. Those are pure memories. The ego adds a label to it. I liked it. It was good. It was bad. It was delicious. It was delightful. All those labels will be added by the ego. That's called samskara. Okay, and then, in addition to that, the ego also puts a label that I want it again. There's a subtle desire also identified with that memory. And that's called vasana. Those are the terms that Patanjali will use in future chapters. Samskara and vasana. In general, many commentators and even many writers, they kind of overlap these two, samskara and vasana. They kind of get to the same thing, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it almost sounds kind of like you're saying.
Similar, but very subtle differences that if you stop at the point of saying that I liked it, that's samskara. If you add the value that I want it again, that's vasana, in a sense. Okay? So that element of desire has been added to that experience. So, obviously, next day you want the same thing again because, oh my God, I had a great experience. So your ego says, let's get it. And then you keep doing it over and over again. It becomes a habit and then it becomes a necessity, and then you start getting headaches if you don't have a cup of coffee, and all that happens. Okay? But that all is based on the ego. Okay? Same thing with the dvesha. If you dislike something, you know, you develop a dislike and hatred for it, then your ego says, I never want that experience again. Absolutely never. I don't want to have anything to do with it again. Okay? So that's the dvesha part. Any unpleasant experience, you don't want to do it again. And they're both dependent on memory from the past experience. That's how they are all created, basically. Pleasurable experiences will cause attachment, and painful experience will cause dvesha. And ego is the root cause of all this, because ego is the one which puts the label in the first place. Okay, so ego is the root cause of raga and dvesha, as it adds labels to each experience. Okay. Okay. Musk deer, which has, where did this come from?
I was wondering, I read that.
Which has fragrance on its forehead but keeps running around. I think I misadded it or something. It should belong somewhere else, actually. It's cut and paste from somewhere else. Not sure how that happened. Okay. So all these desires and all, you know, there is a sutra in Bhagavad Gita, and I think next slide I have that. There are two sutras in Bhagavad Gita which talk, they call it the ladder of destruction or something like that, you know, how desires can cause total destruction. So let's read these two sutras. So there's one, Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, 62 shloka, and then chapter 2, 63 shloka. Okay? So, you want to read, Karen?
While contemplating on the objects of the senses, one develops attachment to them. Attachment leads to desire, and from desire arises anger. Shall I keep going?
Yeah.
Anger leads to the clouding of judgment, which results in bewilderment of the memory. When the memory is bewildered, the intellect gets destroyed, and when the intellect gets destroyed, one is ruined. Kind of almost like lost control of yourself at that point.
That's it. Once you are angry and once unfulfilled desires, that's what he's talking about. Unfulfilled desires can cause so much destruction eventually that you lose total control of yourself.
You know, we have so much anger right now, it's hard to, I don't know how you help people with their anger issues.
I think that's it. I don't think you can help people. No, I think they have to do it themselves.
Yeah, they have to
want
to change.
Well, I guess...
So they don't even know that their anger is causing a misery. Mm-hmm. They just are reacting to whatever.
You see that in your patients?
No, I see that on TV.
On TV. Yeah.
If you watch
the
news...
Much TV.
You know what? Yeah, I don't either. Yeah, I very rarely watch it because of...
Which one?
The news.
If you watch
the news.
If you watch any news, any channel,
there seems to be so much anger.
There's everybody's angry at somebody. It's pretty. You can't watch it for long unless you have a really strong stomach.
Stomach. I don't watch much
TV.
Yeah,
you
didn't miss anything. Don't worry.
Anything.
It is what it is anyway. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. The only thing I watch on TV is sports. That's it.
Sports.
Oh, okay. That's my husband. That's all he likes.
I don't want anything else. Okay, so these are two very, very frequently quoted shlokas from the Bhagavad Gita because they really talk about the desire, you know, all these attachments. Raga, it talks about raga and dvesha, same words he's using in Gita also. And you know, this is what happens when you have these strong desires.
I see raga spelled R-A-G-A, and another time I see it here says R-A-A-G-A.
Just pronunciation.
Just pronunciation.
See, if you do not put two A's, then you might say raga.
Yes.
Okay, or raga or something, you know, you don't know. To distinguish and to make sure that you understand the pronunciation right, it's raga. So the first A is long, mm-hmm. Second A is short. That's why it is. Or you'll put a bar on top of the A to make it raga.
Yeah.
That's the standard diacritical transcription marks.
For Sanskrit, that would be the opposite in English.
No.
Well, if it was an R-A-G-A, wouldn't the A be long?
Yeah.
Like
in
A,
English, you put a line across it for a hard
a.
or long A sound.
Yeah, that's what
yeah.
I'm saying.
Eight. You put a long bar over it. And if you have there's a little upside down U, a U, a lowercase U is a short A sound. That's why it's a little weird when I see that bar across it, because that's not how we pronounce it.
I see.
Yeah, that's not how we pronounce it.
So this is how, this is the international recognized way of... This is international.
This is that way, right?
It's not specific to Sanskrit. So all European languages will have the same.
Yeah.
All European languages will have the same diacritical marks for our transliteration.
Change it to A, like rega.
Exactly.
It would be a long
A. It would be a long A.
I see. I understand. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I've seen that. But that's not how it is.
Okay. Well, that's actually good enough.
See, that carrot sound is not there in Sanskrit at all, so that doesn't matter. You know, like keg, for example, you know, or bed. That sound doesn't...
Sound doesn't exist.
It's like cat. Cat, for
sure. These sounds don't exist in Sanskrit.
It's only ah or ah.
Ah or ah, e or e, a or a, o or o, you know, there's...
It's nice because it can only be one sound, the vowels.
Okay, so now we move to the number five, the fifth klesha, which is called abhinivesha. All right, so let's start the Sanskrit. Swarasavahi,
Swarasavahi,
Vidushopi,
Vidushopi,
Tatharudhah.
That
tatha rudha. Tatha. Oh, you know what?
Yeah.
Oh, it's missing. So, you know, this is my mistake. See, I did a cut and paste from somewhere else, and I didn't pay attention to what I was doing. All right. Abhinaveshaha. The whole thing is messed up. Yeah. I need to correct the Sanskrit as well as the English transliteration. Both of them are wrong. English is wrong, and the Sanskrit also there is mistake.
No, the English is correct.
The English is correct.
Yeah, according to...
English is also wrong.
Why?
Because the Sanskrit says tatharudha, English says samarudha.
Well, in the book it says, clinging to life, that's flowing by its own potency.
Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah.
That's, oh, okay. Yeah.
Oh,
okay.
Sanskrit.
Oh,
no.
The Sanskrit.
The Sanskrit. Transliteration. Yes.
Oh, the
top. I'm talking of the transliteration.
I thought that was a decoration.
Oh, I see, I understand.
Struggle enough to get to the second line.
Right.
Exactly.
Now I know. See, I'm looking at the...
So you're doing it actually from the transcript.
The original Sanskrit is wrong, then the translation is, there is a mistake there.
Okay.
So both of them, you know, I need to fix that. That's what happens when you do cut and paste and you don't pay attention. Oh, that's not good.
I think the Sanskrit's okay.
That abhinivesha, that the avagraha is missing. That S.
Oh.
Abhinivesha.
Abhinivesha.
After tatha rudho, there should be a avagraha. Missing.
Okay.
See, I'm talking of this S.
Oh, that's just the part that joins to a P, right?
I'm talking about this Sanskrit here.
Yeah.
There's an S there, right?
Yeah.
That's called avagraha.
Ah, okay.
That's missing from the text here. Okay, so let's try to see what this might mean now.
Okay.
Swarasavahi. Now, the literal meaning of this word, Swarasavahi, is something that is flowing in its own juice, in a sense, very literal meaning. Rasa means juice, essence of something, rasa. Swa means the self. Vahi means something that is being carried. All right. I'm just giving you a very, very literal meaning.
Sure.
Okay. So something that is flowing in its own current, so to say. Okay. What that really means is something that is flowing due to its own innate nature.
Okay.
All right. Now, the word abhinivesha, again, abhinivesha, it has been translated most commonly as fear of death. Where that comes from? It comes from the root word vish, which means to enter someplace. And nivesh means to enter forcefully. And abhinivesh means to stay and no change. Abhinivesh. So abhinivesha means the tendency to maintain status quo. That means I don't like any change.
To not enter somewhere?
To not make a change, to enter somewhere. To enter into something different, something new. Very subtle meanings.
Yeah, very.
But then most commentators feel that that means fear of death or clinging to life. Okay? So that's the meaning of abhinivesha. Yes. And statha rudha. Rudha means to cling to something. Rudha, tatha. In this manner, to cling to life, even for vidisho. Vidisho means, vidushaha is a guy who is very learned, very wise, who has understood everything in life. So even for a person of that category who has a lot of wisdom, understanding, even for him, fear of death flows like a natural river. It's always there.
Part of his nature.
Okay.
What do you mean? He is fearful of death all
yes.
the time?
Yes.
Even if a person is very wise, okay. Even if he has read Yoga Sutras, for example, okay, even he would be afraid of death when the time comes. You know, intellectually you might say, oh, I'm not afraid of that. I can get it. You know. But when the time comes,
when you're faced
with something, you know, close to it, then it comes out, you know, that fear of death. I don't want to die. Right?
And that comes from the fear of it clinging to what we think.
To what we think is permanent.
What we think is permanent. Yes, that's what I was looking for.
Okay. And this is where, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, they claim, they quote so many different shlokas from Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita talks a lot about death and what it means to die and what it means to stay and cling to this life. Because, you know, one of the very famous shlokas in the Gita is that, you know, this whole body is like, it's like putting on a new shirt. When the old shirt is torn, this body doesn't change. I mean, you still have the same kind of body at a gross level. But then the shirt, you change that. And what they say is in the shloka, what it means is that when a person dies, all it is doing is for the soul to acquire another body. So in that case, the body becomes the shirt. Okay? So I'm the soul, I'm the pure consciousness, and this body is like my shirt on that consciousness. And when this body disappears, so all I need is a new shirt, a new body. And that's what reincarnation is all about. Okay, but we don't understand that. We understand this is the real thing, and we cling to it, and we are deathly afraid of dying, you know, to lose this body, and that's what is this whole abhinivesha is all about. Okay, now what they say is that, you know, these commentators now, they're trying to explain this sutra, and you know, they say that it doesn't matter what species you are, whether you are a bird or an insect or a fly or a human being, even the most newly born infant has a certain fear of hurt, injury, death eventually. You know, even this, the example they gave is if you show a, if you raise a stick in front of a newly born cat or something, it'll pull back. Fear. Because that is, where does that come from, they say? From previous lives. Because you have a samskara, a memory from previous life's death experiences, and which has been painful, always. Death is always painful, they say. Therefore, you have that samskara in you, no matter how, you know, what species you are. You all of us have that fear of death, based on the past memory. Okay? I just put that example of a security alarm system. You know, we all like to do that. Some people like to do that. I never. So, people are afraid, basically. It's all fear, nothing else. Just fear. Must have come from a previous birth. Even a vidusha, a learner or a wise person, has fear of death. And I again quoted that Bhagavad Gita shloka here. Just as we discard old clothes and get new ones, our soul discards the old body and gets a new one after the physical body dies. So fear of death is like the mother of all fears, but in my understanding, this Abhinivesha really deals with all kinds of fear. We have fear of loss, we have fear of future, fear of this, fear of that. Fear happens at every step in our life. All kinds of fear. Fear of the unknown. And Abhinivesha represents that because it comes from our raga and dvesha. We like something, we're always afraid, oh my God, am I going to lose it? If we dislike something, oh my God, when am I going to get rid of it? Right? It's like getting married. Oh my God, when am I going to get married? You know?
And then you do it.
When am I going to get when am I going to get rid of
did I get married?
When am I going to get rid of this person now?
Yeah,
how did I get rid of it? You know? So it's always fear. Always fear. If I don't have a job, you know, oh my God.
I want a job.
When you get a job, I don't know what to do with it now, you know. Fear of all the time.
So does Patanjali just say, okay, this exists? Yeah. Or does he talk about, go further and say, okay, how do we relieve ourselves from this fear?
Non-attachment.
I mean,
non-attachment.
So all these things are coming.
All those things are okay.
That's the whole purpose is to explain all this. He doesn't go into the actual techniques, like he doesn't say do the warrior pose and all that.
Right. So his is more of an explanation.
Explanation at a higher
way, either through meditation.
Concepts, yes.
Yeah, concepts.
He talks about concepts.
A way of really looking at our life.
Yes.
In this universe or whatever.
Looking at life.
Work.
Looking at my life. It's all about the individual. Predominantly, Patanjali is all geared to the individual. There are concepts that relate to social interactions and all that, but mostly it is all individual. Okay. Now, you know, again, the commentators are trying to understand what Patanjali is saying. I've been quite a bit confused with these few statements here. How to get rid of these kleshas, right? Okay. So the very first statement we said was Kriya Yoga, Tapas, Swadhyaya, Ishwar Pranidhana. It says the purpose of Kriya Yoga was to diminish these kleshas.
Yes.
Diminish the influence of these kleshas. Now here, it goes a little more into it, okay? So let me read this Sanskrit first. Te prati prasava heyaha. Let's break it down. Te, first word is te.
Te
prati prasava.
Prati
Heyaha
Sukshmaha.
So te pratiprasava heyaha
Sukshmaha.
All right, now what does that mean? The word, the pratiprasava is a combination of prati and prasava. Prasava means to give birth to something. Prasava means to give birth. And pratiprasava is the opposite. What's the opposite of giving birth? To resolve it back, something back into the source. Okay. So if I were to put a child back into the mother's womb, that would be called pratiprasava in a sense. All right? So, these kleshas, te means these kleshas, he's talking about these kleshas, these five afflictions, to remove them, heya means to remove them. To remove these kleshas, you have to put them back to their own source. Now, this is a very deep concept here, and this is where the whole Sankhya philosophy comes into play. You know, you have to go back to understanding how the whole creation took place and how all these elements function and all that. So I've talked about it a few times before. You know, they say that the creation, this human creation, took place because there was a disturbance in the three gunas. The initial state of the prakriti is called mula prakriti, mula, which is the base or the root prakriti. Which represents a balanced state of the three gunas. Sattva, rajas and tamas. When they are balanced, what that balance means we don't know. It just means there is no perturbation within the qualities of these gunas. Okay? So, when there was balance, there was no manifestation. But at some point in time, that balance was disturbed. Through the presence of Purusha. That's how they did. There's no real explanation of all that. Okay, but when that imbalance happens, creation starts. And the first thing that gets created is the intellect, buddhi. And from, and I'm going through it very, very quickly now. So otherwise, you know, it's a very long understanding of this whole creation. But buddhi comes first, then the ahankara or the ego comes next, then the mind comes next. Okay? So buddhi, ego, mind, and then the five sense perceptions. Sense of smell, touch, taste, and all that.
What do you mean, they evolve in an individual?
Yes.
An individual is being born?
Or? Yes, when the individual is...
Okay, this is that we're talking about the individual level again.
Right, okay. Individual level. Your glasses fell down?
Oh, okay, so first you said is the what's born first?
The intellect.
Intellect, huh?
That's what they, you know, this is all a Sankhya now. If you go to the Sankhya philosophy, that's how they explain all this stuff. So intellect, then the ego, then the mind, then the five sense perceptions, then the five sense, sense organs, then the five organs of action, and five elements finally. So there are 23 elements that we talk about.
Yeah.
Okay, so these are this is how the evolution takes place. So they are from the subtle to the gross, to the grosser and to the grossest. The earth is the grossest of all these. Okay, then the earth, water, fire, and then from there you go into the subtler ones. So the five sense perceptions are subtle. Mind is subtler than that. Then the ego is even subtler than that, and intellect is at the most subtle level. That's how they claim. Now what they claim is pratiprasava, this word pratiprasava means to go back to the source, which means you start going backwards now. Resolve things back from gross to the subtle, to the subtler, to the subtlest. And when that happens, there is a progressive diminishing of the fluctuation of the three gunas. Okay? So eventually when you are able to go and go back and merge back into the mula prakriti, then the three gunas eventually get balanced again.
Do they tell you in this book how to get these merged back?
Well, I mean, eventually the whole process is meditation. Eventually.
That's like the ultimate. That's the one thing we're always getting back to in meditation.
Meditation is the key, but eight limbs of yoga, that's what he eventually comes to, eight limbs of yoga. Patanjali, you know, that's where in second chapter, like I said, he introduces the eight limbs of yoga. So eventually he says, through these eight limbs of yoga, all this will happen. Okay. Through the practice of these eight limbs. So there's sutra number 28, you know, which will tell us what the eight limbs will do for us.
So through yoga, you go deeper and deeper and deeper.
Yes, yes. So in subtle form, so
the unmanifest prakriti is before mula prakriti?
No, that's mula prakriti.
That is mula.
Yes.
Okay.
So, you know, like I said, these statements, I've been kind of confused with these, you know. I'm trying. They are pretty abstract. And see, this one, these three are very confusing. Okay? Okay.
Okay, in the active state, no, I get that one. In the active state, they can be destroyed by meditation.
Right. So, in the very first one, when Kriya Yoga was practiced, they said they will diminish the tanukarana. They will diminish the influence of the five kleshas. Alright? Now, in this one, it says, when they are very subtle, when they are in the sukshma means very subtle. So in the very subtle form, they can be eliminated by completely resolving back to the source. That means merging back with the mula prakriti. Okay? Now, that's the very subtle ones. Now here it says the vrittis, that means when they are active state. When they are in the active state, then they can be diminished or destroyed by meditation. But meditation is the key to everything, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's why, you know, these three statements, I don't get them.
So meditate.
Okay? What's the difference? But here he's specifically saying that in the active state they can be destroyed by meditation. But meditation is...
But aren't those the things that are like you're visibly like upset about or something?
Yeah,
but of course, but then if you go deeper into your... why you became upset about something, that gets deeper, and then you'd still destroy it, like you said, by meditation, because...
So my point is, you know, he has given three different techniques of dealing with these kleshas. And to me, I don't understand the real difference.
Why make the distinctions?
Why make the distinction? Explain, what I would have liked is explain to us that these are these three different levels of kleshas. Mm-hmm. They can be at the subtle level, gross level, or whatever. Yeah. But eventually, to get rid of all that, meditate.
Yeah.
I would prefer that. But he's, you know, giving three different techniques, and commentators don't understand it, in my opinion. You know.
What are the three different techniques he gives you?
Kriya Yoga was number one. In the very first sutra, he says Kriya Yoga is to diminish the influence of the Tanukarana. The Tanukarana means to diminish the influence.
And Kriya Yoga includes meditation.
Yes.
Kriya Yoga includes meditation.
No, it is tapas, swadhyaya, nishar, panidhana. It doesn't use the word in meditation.
Okay.
Okay, it doesn't use the word meditation. Okay? But then, remember, this was second one. Pratiprasava. Go back to the source. How do you go back to the source without meditation?
Right. Yeah. Got me.
How do you go back to the source? That's the only way I know, right? And then, so he says to all the subtle ones, you have to go back to the source. Bring them, that's the ultimate. That's the ultimate samadhi, you know, the asamprajnata samadhi. That's what it is. And then he says that for those vrittis which are in the active state, vrittis are, you know, everything that's happening at the active level in the mind, vrittis. To diminish those, then use dhyana. Dhyana is meditation.
Can he be like the active state, be getting mixed up in the karmas, the three different kind of karmas?
That's all active, yeah. Sure.
Because, well, the act of karma, but then you have karma from a previous life and you have karma.
Whatever, but the point is, whether it's from the previous life or whether it's from a previous memory, it's right now active in my mind. I'm angry at this point. Yeah. That's an active vritti. Okay. I'm jealous at this point. That's an active vritti. Or I'm desiring coffee. That's an active vritti. It's not hidden. It's not in the subconscious level. It's right there. I want coffee right now.
I have some techniques that I use for when I'm upset, but, you know, I don't know.
It's not necessarily upset. I'm saying even anything.
Or just to remove something that is upsetting me.
Yeah, okay.
What does he mean when he says something is in subtle form?
Subtle forms, that means the active component has been diminished. It has been reduced, made feeble. Now it has gone into the deeper,
deep
into the subconscious level. It's in the subtle form now.
And now when someone does a little thing, you get upset a lot easier because you've put it in your subconscious and you didn't deal with it. You have to deal with it to not get it pushed back in.
Replace it.
Yeah, I do. That's one of the techniques.
So this is an area which has confused me a lot. And when we were discussing it in our Sutra study group, even there we could not resolve this as to these three different techniques or three different stages of activities that Patanjali is talking about. And I have read many different commentaries, at least 8 or 10 different commentaries, and I still don't get it as to what exactly.
Could it refer to like deeper states of meditation?
It's possible, you know, but we don't know what that means.
Swami Satchidananda doesn't even comment on that one.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't. Okay, no commentary with that one.
Because he doesn't understand himself.
He doesn't understand, so I don't know what this is.
I'm going there this weekend. I'll ask about the sutra. I'll ask the Swami.
Bring them in the context of these three, okay? Kriya Yoga, subtle ones, and this final vrittayaha.
What is that, 9, 10, and 11?
No. First one is the 1 and 2.
1 and 2.
Okay, 1 and 2, okay. And then 10 and 11.
Okay.
9, 10, 11 then, yeah.
Okay, I'll do it. I'll find out.
So what's the difference, you know?
Okay.
1,
2, 10, 11, 2.
All right. And I've spent a lot of time trying to understand this, and it still doesn't. Like they say, you know, I've gone through many books, but the books haven't gone through me yet. Okay. I would actually prefer to stop here today. Is that okay with everyone?
Yes.
I know it's early, but
we've taken in a lot.
Maybe he's just trying to give many examples of more than one technique. He just wants to make sure he throws everything out there so that you have more ways to deal with it than.
Yeah, but the ways.
There's no other way to deal with it. There is only meditation.
You know, the techniques are not specifically given. All it says is bring it back to the source. How do you do that? He doesn't tell you that.
Meditation, more time, meditation.
He doesn't tell you that. He says, pratiprasava hai yaha, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pratiprasava means bring it to the source. Merge it backwards.
Yeah.
But what do you do to get there? So that's what I'm saying. You know, to me, it's a kind of hazy, you know, this whole concept of what he's trying to say. I don't know.